طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. There is a shift in the way that the Palestinian narrative is discussed in the media, on campuses, and on the streets of America within the last few years. It is not dramatic and has not yet much affected Washington politics, but it is evolving. Today, on This Week in Palestine, we take a deep dive into that dynamic with Tariq Kenny Shawa, who has studied the dynamic of this shift and discusses it on the Occupied podcast, recorded on September 22nd, 2021, with Laura Friedman and Khaled El-Gindi. So what are the prospects for change in the United States politics and policies? How does all of this relate to the situation on the ground in Palestine today? And what hope does this offer for achieving Palestinian rights and liberation? Laura Friedman begins with the introduction.
So welcome, Todd. We're so happy to have you. Can you, just as a starting point, can you introduce yourself briefly to the audience with a little more personal data than what was in that bio paragraph? Where are you from? Where's your family from? What are you most interested and passionate about when it comes to research and policy fields?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the introduction, Laura and Khaled. Hello, everybody. I'm Tariq Kenny Shawa. As Khaled mentioned, I'm currently a second year Master's in International Affairs candidate at Columbia SIPA. And I'm studying, as Khaled said, the intersection of security, conflict resolution, and then my specific interest is journalism. I was born in New York. My father's Palestinian, my mom's American. Kind of starting from that, very different kind of backgrounds. And then I spent most of my life growing up in the Middle East, but there was a lot of back and forth between the Middle East and New York. So at the end of the day, New York has kind of felt like home to me. But I think that childhood kind of informed my interest in my overarching interest in international relations, politics. And then over time, I became more and more interested in storytelling and how the way we tell stories, kind of molds our political perspectives and in a larger extent molds foreign policy itself. So I think that's kind of what pushed me down this path, so to say. And I'm still excited to see where it ends up. I've got one more year of graduate school left, and then it's kind of a return to the real world.
Great. So Tariq, recently you wrote an article that was published in 972 magazine entitled "Palestinian Americans Are Turning the Tide of U.S. Policy." So for folks who haven't seen that, we'll include a link here in the text that accompanies this podcast. This piece is interesting because it's also the subject of your research at MEI for this coming, for your graduate fellowship. So there's lots of reasons to sort of probe it. And it's especially timely, I think, just given recent events. So we have a lot to ask you about, but let me start with this. So you write specifically that Palestinian Americans are, quote, indelibly shifting the narrative around Palestinian liberation, and that this was clear during what you describe as the widespread mobilization of Palestinians and their supporters. So can you talk a little bit about this mobilization, what it looked like and what impacts it had? And also, how has this recent mobilization sort of played out recently in the context of the Gaza and Jerusalem crisis that we saw this past May?
Sure.
Especially in comparison to previous conflicts that we saw, for example, the 2014 Gaza war. What was different this time around versus last time?
Yeah. So to give some background on kind of my current research focus, I'm really looking at, you know, the shifting narrative around Palestine and the Palestinian struggle in the context of public opinion in general, but mainly in the U.S. because of my Palestinian American background and focus. And then going further, how it may or may not translate into actual changes in U.S. foreign policy. So kind of along that vein, part of what I want to determine is whether there's a general threshold that these types of issues must actually cross in order to actually impact U.S. Foreign policy decisions. So this summer, while I've yet to do actual, you know, survey analysis, and while I hope to do more actual in-depth analysis of this, I think there's definitely a noticeable shift in the narrative around Palestine and the Palestinian struggle. And I think pretty much it can be kind of boiled down to several factors, one of them being the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement last summer, which really, I think, galvanized you know, the social justice movement in the U.S. and kind of opened up the conversation for some of these issues around systemic racism, police brutality, and white supremacy. You know, these issues, and I think a lot of them intersect and can be applied to the conversation on Palestine. So I think that was, you know, a fundamental part of making the conversation that we had this summer about what happened in May and June in Sheikh Jarrah and Gaza. That's really some of the main factors that made it possible. But as you mentioned, I think a more long-term contributing factor to this shift has been emerging young Palestinian American activists who have grown up with their parents' stories, grown up with a very deep connection to Palestine and a strong desire to get involved and a strong desire to place themselves in positions of influence and actually influence U.S. policy. So while it's difficult to actually record kind of this metric change between this summer and 2014 and, for example, 2008, just because it's, you know, it's a long process of analyzing data on Twitter, you know, hashtags, quotes, etc. I think there's been a noticeable shift in the online discourse in the progressive community, and not just the progressive community, as well as moderates and you know, people across the spectrum, in which not only are people actually talking about Palestine, Israel, and what's happening, for example, in Gaza, people are actually sympathizing more with Palestinians and tying their struggle to what's going on in many cases in the U.S. And I think that's the main thing that I noticed has shifted, is just the public discourse, is the number of people speaking out for Palestine and not only on social media in the halls of Congress, when we have representatives like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and the growing list of progressive representatives who are actually championing the Palestinian cause in Congress. And I think that's another example of just the tangibility of this shift.
Thanks, Tarek. And I know that we want to get back to you a little bit more on the what's behind the shift in the narrative or in the grassroots. I'd like to go back to your piece again. I'm going to read you part of the piece. You said that the events of the past summer, quote, reminded the diaspora of our integral function in the increasingly diverse global movement for Palestinian liberation, More importantly, Palestinians have proven not only that we are less fragmented than we had feared, but there we're indelibly shifting in that language, the narrative around our struggle for liberation. So I want you to talk a little bit more about this impact. So how has the narrative changed from what you've seen? Or again, I know you want to do broader research, but just impressionistically, how has that narrative changed? What is shifting specifically about it? And with whom? Who's being impacted by this engagement? And how, if you can talk a little more, how you see this playing out in progressive politics itself?
So I think the main shift is formalizing in people's approach to viewing Israel as a stable ally of the United States that shares values and political ideologies with the United States. And I think what has changed is that more people are drawing attention to the realities of occupation, the realities of the war crimes that Israel commits in Gaza, the realities of the ethnic cleansing that are ongoing in across the Palestinian territories, but especially in May and Sheikh Jarrah, and that are still ongoing. And I think this is obviously more effective when it comes to people on the left, the Democratic Party, because I don't want to jump the gun here, because in the U.S., I mean, the U.S. is still a very pro-Israel oriented voting base and a very pro-Israel oriented leadership. But I mean, in recent polls, I mean, there's been a shift on the left and in general. I think it was 48% of Democrats sympathize more with Palestinians compared to 33% with Israel in one of the biggest shifts in years. And then further data points point to growing generational divides with, younger Americans substantially more sympathetic to Palestinians. And then this is kind of expected, I guess, with the Democratic Party, which has started incorporating more and more progressive, issues into its general platform, but I think a more surprising shift is actually the changes in public opinion among evangelicals, which have been described as Israel's most reliable support base in the U.S. And Shibli Telhami actually recently conducted a study. He's I believe at the University of Maryland, where I think 40% of younger evangelicals. And this was from 2015, I believe, wanted the U.S. to lean more towards Israel over the Palestinians, while only 21% shared that same sentiment in 2018. So that's a notable shift in evangelicals who, have served as a very staunch supporter of Israel. So I think not only with regards to, the U.S., left and the Democrats, I think that this shift is kind of happening across the board as people are able to more clearly, see the Palestinian narrative and understand the Palestinian perspective, and then in turn empathize with Palestinians themselves.
So really what we're talking about is a broader, what it sounds like is we're talking about a broader shift in public opinion in general, or is it sort of concentrated in specific, with specific constituencies, the young, women, people of color, people I self-identify as liberal, or is there a broader shift? Because, the example you gave of public opinion among evangelicals, that's, I think, pretty surprising. I think a lot of people would find that kind of unexpected. So is there a broader shift? And I want to get at, like, what is your take on what is fueling this shift? Is it, is the narrative shifting because the message and the messenger is changing? Or is it because of the receptivity of those receiving the message has changed, or some combination? Is this just a function of people learning more about Palestine, or is there something deeper, maybe more ideological, going on in sort of American culture?
I just add, I mean, also learning more about what's happening with Israel, the sort of, is it the people now, it's the de-exceptionalization of Israel as there's freer flow of information. Is that a complementary factor, maybe?
Yeah, so, yeah, and if I could just tack on to that too, sorry to bombard you.
It'd be a very big question.
Yeah, it's a big question, because I think this is really what ultimately people want to know, is where is this coming from? Because that helps us understand where this might be headed. Are there particular groups, you know, in terms of the audience and the message and the messenger, are there particular groups or movements that you see as spearheading this effort or this shift?
Yeah. So, okay. So it's, I definitely believe it's, you know, kind of like a huge mix of kind of like all these different factors coming together to kind of like push this change. But to address the first question, I definitely believe that this shifting perspective on Israel is definitely very much concentrated. It's definitely more concentrated among progressives, Democrats, but as the data says, it is also shifting the national conversation as well. So while it is making more headway amongst Democrats and progressives, the rest of the U.S. population is kind of following suit. And I guess, you know, some people could tie this to general political trends and how, you know, politics slowly ebbs and flows over time between, you know, shifting left and for example, Bernie Sanders' presidential election campaign kind of like showed, it's these opinions are getting more and more popular amongst the general voting population. So yes, while it is definitely concentrated within the Democratic and Progressive Party, it is also showing signs of shifting the general population. And then to address the next question, sorry, you're going to have to remind me which was next in this order.
My piece of it was, are there particular groups or movements that you see as kind of spearheading this shift? And just to sort of give you a little bit more context, what I find really remarkable about this moment is, if one were to do a cost analysis of, you know, dollar for dollar spent on pro-Israel advocacy versus pro-Palestine advocacy, I mean, the gap is enormous, right? I mean, there are institutions, we all know them by name, that are dedicated, you know, to preserving and expanding the U.S.-Israel relationship and deepening that exceptionalism that Lara talked about. If you look at the infrastructure of Palestine advocacy, it's far, far smaller. And I'm, you know, I can't help but wonder if they're sort of punching way above their weight, right? I mean, the you know, we still have a long way to go in terms of changing the politics and the policy, but there is that noticeable shift. So I'm just curious, are there particular groups that you think are more responsible for driving that change?
Absolutely. So I think, yeah, as you said, I do agree that pro-Palestine groups in the U.S. especially have been punching above their weight, especially in regards to just looking at, you know, funding levels. Pro-Israel lobbying groups like for example, AIPAC spend at a much higher level than any similar comparison in regards to pro-Palestine groups. Not that there is really a similar comparison, because there isn't.
Or any combination of groups, even.
Combination of groups, yeah, because there isn't that same centralized lobbying, very well-funded and government-funded lobbying source. So the source of support from Palestinians has been, by and large, grassroots efforts led by protest groups, led by, you know, Palestinian-American activists, led by individuals, and led by, you know, emerging groups like the Institute for Middle East Understanding, IMEU, for example, or even you know, organizations like, for example, Let's Talk Palestine has been very active on social media, and has been very active in kind of you know, developing this discourse and guiding it in the right direction. And then I also want to kind of draw attention to the work of organizations like Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, which, you know, kind of more recently have drawn more attention to the apartheid nature of Israel. And I think it's important because, of course, you know, Palestinians have been making that argument for years, but I think it really ties into our argument, and it really, you know, kind of gives the Palestinian movement fuel to and kind of like a legal basis to work off of. And I think that's been extremely important in, you know, contributing to this shift in narrative, because it's given people a legal framework through which to actually view Israel's occupation and actually view Israel's treatment of Palestinian citizens of Israel, etc.
Thanks. I want to shift a little bit to the question of policy. So we're talking about public opinion and narrative, and we've talked a little bit, you mentioned Bernie Sanders' campaign politics. We've seen, you know, the emergence of a more vocal contingent in Congress that expresses concern for Palestinian rights. Where do you see the likelihood of this shifting, this delivering a change in policy? Because we haven't really seen that yet, right? And to the extent that the Biden administration has differed from the Trump administration in many areas, or claimed it's going to roll back things that Trump did on Israel-Palestine, I mean, the policies are pretty status quo. The discourse for folks who listened to confirmation hearing today for the new ambassador, or last week for the assistant secretary. But, you know, at the same time, we have yesterday's drama over Iron Dome. So what are your thoughts on translating the prospects of seeing this translate to a shift in policy?
So that's the question that I think my longer term research hopes to answer. And but right off the bat, I think the question of when it's going to actually impact U.S. policy is going to be a matter of years or decades. I think that the changes we've been seeing in you know, public discourse, this narrative, this cultural hegemony that that has kind of been present for so long. These are very, very gradual changes that require decades and decades of, in a sense, seeping into the public's understanding of Palestine, of Palestinians and the Palestinian struggle and the you know, this, the experiences that Palestinians go through. I think that in order for it to translate to policy, actually U.S. policy, is going to take decades. And I think, you know, something that's I've been thinking about recently to kind of, you know, compare it to is the, you know, the popularity of Medicare for all in the U.S. I mean, you know, poll after poll has surveyed general, you know, population opinion on Medicare for all and has found that it is widely popular, even a majority in many cases, and has increased over time. Yet the Democratic Party, despite the fact that that is even more pronounced within the Democratic Party and within the emerging progressive component of the Democratic Party, they have yet to kind of like incorporate that or even like a serious debate about that into their platform. So I, to be honest, and perhaps this is a pessimistic approach to it, but I worry that, you know, there could be an even more substantial shift in public opinion around Palestine, to which a growing number of Americans, you know, call for, you know, conditioning U.S. aid to Israel, call for, you know, eventually, you know, supporting, you know, movements like BDS, but that you know, reluctance to actually incorporate it into mainstream platforms slows that process down. But I mean, the other argument is that, as we saw yesterday, with the progressive component of Congress, kind of, or of the Democrats pressuring them to remove that the $1 billion additional funding for the Iron Dome system. That's while it is problematic for Democrats in the long run, you know, strategically, I think that does show that, okay, things on the ground are, you know, shifting when it comes to actual policy change. But as I said before, I think it's going to be decades before we see substantial changes that will actually have an impact on the occupation itself.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one of the most striking things about the whole Iron Dome drama over the past day or so is that there is a group in Congress that is actually willing to take political risks and hits because they're being criticized across the board from the right and from the left and from the center. Was this really a strategic move? Aren't they shooting themselves in the foot? This is going to pass anyway in a different form. Why are they falling on their sword? But what it really shows is that there is a group that is prepared to pay a political price. And I don't recall a time when that was the case. Sort of shifting gears a little bit to look at the Palestinian side of this equation. I want to ask you, so in your 972 piece, the same piece that we've been talking about, you also write that the May crisis in Jerusalem and Gaza demonstrated that Palestinians are not as fragmented as many of them and many others thought they were. So what exactly do you mean by that? I mean, is this a new era of Palestinian unity, or what does it mean in practical terms?
So I think that in May and June, we saw kind of an unprecedented level of Palestinian unity within the West Bank, Gaza, the even surrounding countries like Jordan. For example, when thousands of people marched towards the border of the West Bank from in Jordan, I think that is something we haven't seen in years. And then the repeated and connected uprisings in towns and cities within Israel, I think that kind of showed in a way that hasn't been evident over the past several years that Israel's policy and Israel's ongoing policy, though very effective of divide and conquer, has not totally silenced a collective Palestinian struggle. But to say that it's a turning point would be, I think, jumping the gun a little bit, just because of the amount of obstacles Palestinians face in Palestine and Israel to collective action. And I think what the aftermath of May and June kind of showed in regards to the Palestinian authorities' crackdown on public dissent, on peaceful protests, I think that goes to show just how many obstacles the Palestinians within places like the West Bank and Gaza still still face, because I mean they're up against not only Israel, but they're up against their own leadership. So there's definitely this dissonance between what I see as the Palestinian streets, the grassroots efforts, and the Palestinian leadership. So I think the bigger fragmentation now isn't necessarily between territory. It isn't necessarily between the West Bank and Gaza. It isn't necessarily between Palestine and the diaspora. I think the big gap in understanding is between the general grassroots Palestinian activists and their leadership. And I think that's going to be the biggest hindrance for collective action in regards to kind of like formulating a new political approach and a new collective strategy.
So you have perfectly anticipated the direction I wanted to go with this, which is, so you've got this growing distrust of leadership, frustration with authoritarianism, corruption, incompetence, confidence is at an all-time low. We saw polling, I think, today on this. And of course, the protests, which were sort of brutally repressed, and the whole discourse around the murder of Nizar Banat. So assuming that you could actually see the shift in narrative that you're talking about relate to a shift in politics and maybe even in policy, how does this affect the actual interests of Palestinians absent a credible Palestinian leadership that can capitalize on it?
I think that's the question to ask next. And it's something else I'm also hoping to kind of delve into a little bit further with my research is that, of course, you know, narrative can be a tool for liberation, but how can we advance it further than just, you know, debating, okay, is narrative shifting or isn't? And I think the first issue is to address is that fragmentation that I just discussed. Both the fragmentation within, you know, between Palestinians that has shown to be less of a serious issue, you know, after May, since we've had such, you know, just in light of the territorial solidarity, but more in regards to, you know, our leadership. So I think it's pretty widely known now that the Palestinian struggle is at a crossroads. It's becoming increasingly recognized that the two-state solution has failed and has, you know, been defunct for a long time now. And the one-state reality has become increasingly entrenched. And I think this, and this is what many people are saying, this is not something new at all. I mean, a lot of Palestinian activists, both in the U.S., in Palestine, are saying that this necessitates a paradigmatic shift in political strategy. But the fragmentation and this disconnect between, you know, grassroots activists and the leadership has postponed this debate and has forced us into this kind of dead end of, you know, pushing our diplomatic avenues towards, you know, this failed push for two states and ignoring the more important debate now that I feel is to explore alternatives. And I want to be clear that I'm not arguing specifically for one or the other political endpoints. I think there is a lot of disagreement still within amongst Palestinians about, you know, what level of what specific political, you know, organization they would support. But I think this debate needs to be held at a higher level, not just within, you know, the grassroots activist circles. And I think this debate needs to be held at a higher diplomatic level in order for it to gain legitimacy.
Picking up on that very thought. So, you know, you write in this piece about this new collective voice that is speaking out for Palestinian rights, this that is, you know, coalescing among Palestinians, both inside and outside of Palestine. And that's, you know, that's very important. You know, mobilization and new platforms are critical. But I sort of keep coming back to this question of wither politics. You know, how can you really bring about any real change without politics and specifically institutional politics? And so, as you know, this past, you know, earlier this year, there were elections scheduled for Palestinians. They were supposed to be across the board for Palestinian Legislative Council, for the presidency, and even for the PLO's parliament, the PNC. Those were summarily canceled at the last minute by President Abbas, one of the many reasons for his very sharp decline in popularity. One thing that we've seen, though, is that young people, I think there was a lot of excitement around the idea of elections because Palestinians are starved for change and starved for participatory politics. But I noticed among younger people, there was a kind of, you know, by which I mean like in their 20s and 30s, who were skeptical or at least ambivalent about the prospect of elections, that maybe their elections, you know, might end up doing more harm than good, or at least consolidating some of these negative trends. And there's a whole movement, actually, I think it's called the Jil al-Jadid, right? That is sort of pushing against elections and in a different direction. So I'm just curious where you fall on the institutional politics or lack thereof question for Palestinians. Should they have elections? What should those elections be for? If not, what's the alternative to bringing about political change or reform?
I think that's a great question. And it's a question that I'm not sure I have you know, a full confident answer to, because it's something that I'm still mulling over and that I want to be mulling over in the long term. I think before, you know, first, a big thing that I want to work on and that I think, you know, we should work on is trying to establish better bridges between the Palestinian diaspora and Palestinians in Palestine, so that we can, you know, kind of merge these conversations, so that it's not like, you know, we're having one conversation in the US about Palestinian politics and Palestinians in Palestine are having an entirely different conversation. And that often is the case. And while we do, you know, see eye to eye on many, many things strategically, I worry sometimes that there's a dissonance between diaspora political discourse and political discourse in Palestine. So that's first, that would be, you know, in order to answer that question, I think better bridges need to be built between these two segments of the Palestinian population, so that we can have this, you know, political conversation together. And then to address your question about, to address your question about, you know, the elections themselves, is what I worry is that, I would have welcomed elections. I would celebrate any opportunity to not have Abbas continue as you know, the Palestinian representative. But at the same time, I wonder if elections would just be kind of allowing the entrenchment of this inherently. Oh, did we lose Khalid?
Keep going. Anyways, I'll come back.
I worry that it would kind of cause the entrenchment of this kind of, you know, post Oslo inherently flawed political order that just allows for the creation of a Palestinian authority that is solely oriented towards making occupation easier for Israel. So the conversation I think we need to be having isn't necessarily just about, are we going to have elections or not? And I think that's kind of tripped us up a lot, because we've gotten into kind of like circular conversations about, are we going to have elections, or is Abbas going to cancel them, which eventually inevitable. I think the conversation should be, is what do we want our leadership to look like? What do we want our political, our long-term political objectives to be? And what kind of framework do we want to fit them into? Because at the end of the day, if elections were held, we would have a new president, right? But we would be in the same political situation. The occupation would be the same. Everything down to the areas that the PA has sovereignty, quote unquote, over would remain the same. So I think the framework itself of a Palestinian authority needs to be debated. And I think the issue with this election discourse is that question is being relegated to, you know, the ivory tower discussions. And I think that needs to be the conversation we're having, you know, on the ground, rather than just amongst us.
So I think as the last question, I want to circle back to something you talked about earlier, which was the sort of political moment we're in and how it interacts with the Palestinian cause. The global movement for rights, you know, the movement for decolonization, for equity, not just equality, but equity. Can you talk a little bit about that and about how this generation, in that sense at least, differs? And not just on Israel-Palestine, the sort of activism of this generation differs. And specifically, when it comes to the Palestinians of younger Palestinians in the diaspora, how this relates to how one thinks about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or whatever you want to call it, and the Nakba itself. And what resolution means.
So I think to frame my answer, I want to quickly just explain the importance of the international community in the Palestinian struggle. I think unfortunately Palestinians themselves do not hold significant hard leverage over their occupier, and in order to you know, end the occupation, and in order to exert pressure on an occupying force, you're going to need international support. And this was what was seen in apartheid South Africa. So that while grassroots efforts led by Palestinians in Palestine will always be the spearhead, will always be the most important factor and must be focused on and sustained, I think that cultivating international support in a very similar way that was done in South Africa is going to be crucial to pressuring and pressuring Israel to loosen its grip. But I think that, as you mentioned, I think the changing conversation today, what that does is that enables this. And I think that what the issue is that, 10 years ago, while Palestinians were more or less saying the same thing, more or less making the same arguments about apartheid, about war crimes, for example, in 2008 or 2014, I think today's political environment where people are more receptive and open to having this discourse around human rights, around equity, around applying these conditions not only in the U.S. but to a general approach to humanity, I think that has been critical in allowing this conversation to continue. And then what that means for the Palestinian struggle itself, and what that means for a solution to this. For lack of better words, conflict, or for this solution, this an end to this occupation, is that I think solutions are going to take a very different form than just the simple kind of straightforward, you get this, I get that independence. I think a solution is going to have to be a lot more collective, and it's going to really involve a lot more creativity than has been, put into it as of late.
You have been listening to scholar Tariq Kenny Shawa speaking originally on the Occupied broadcast about the populace's shifting responses to Israel's occupation of Palestine. Unfortunately, as I mentioned on top, the politics are not visibly shifting in Washington. Palestinian liberation is still the third rail of American politics. That was recently evident when Vice President Kamala Harris spoke at George Mason University. A Palestinian student in the question and answer session spoke of the plight of her people living under Israeli occupation in Palestine. Harris's response was empathetic, but rather politically neutral, but it was seen as critical of Israel and thus anti-Semitic. The Israeli lobby unloaded on her, and she ended up backing away from her statement. When the White House feels it is necessary to back down, we have a first-rate illustration of the power of the Israeli lobby. The same can be said of Representative Rashida Tlaib, who dared to challenge the Israeli apartheid state on the floor of the House of Representatives. She was vilified and criticized for being anti-Semitic. So unfortunately, the movement of the American people toward a more positive view of the Palestinians' struggle for liberation has not yet penetrated our elected representatives in Washington. That is why they have to hear from us. Change comes from pressure, and that is what we have to apply to our representatives in Washington. Only 9 members of Congress oppose sending additional money to Israel to enhance its military defense from the so-called Palestinian aggression. What a sad commentary on how Israel plays the Congress to keep the flow of money to the 5th largest military on the planet to fund its occupation of Palestine. I encourage you to engage with your representatives in Washington on behalf of Palestinians So the Congress begins to feel the change which is taking place on the street concerning the struggle for Palestinian rights. Only pressure will work, and that must come from us. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.